Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcast and Electronic Communication Arts at San Francisco State University. I will be your moderator for today's program called The Islamic State. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Beginning at the end of the table, Dr. Meher Khaleji. Now, Dr. Khaleji was born in Jordan and completed his university education in the UK. He has a PhD in chemistry. After completing his national service in Jordan, he returned to the UK and worked in academia, eventually as full professor, until 2009, after which he moved to San Francisco, where he now lives. Between 2011 and 2014, he was a scientific advisor in the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. He traveled extensively throughout the world and worked with graduate students and university professors from most countries in the Middle East and North Africa, where he still maintains these contacts. Then we have Karaman Mamand, who is a Kurdish human rights activist and lawyer. We also are very fortunate to be joined by the Honorary Consul General for the Republic of Turkey in the San Francisco Bay Area, Bonnie Joy Kaslan. Bonnie Joy will also be the host of the legendary Turkey tour for Commonwealth Club members, called From Istanbul to the Turquoise Coast. That will be in October 2015. And please feel free to ask Bonnie about more details about that or visit the website to sign up for the tour. And last but certainly not least, Dr. Karima Benoun, a professor of international law at UC Davis and author of Your Fatwa Does Not Belong Here. Professor Benoun will be signing her book after our program and will begin with a brief overview of the Islamic State.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. It's always nice to be introduced by someone who knows exactly how to pronounce my name. So I was asked to give an overview of the so-called Islamic State, and I'm going to do that in a human rights sense. And I have to do that very briefly, so please bear with me. There'll be a number of things that I will need to leave out. So this so-called Islamic State was born, we know, in the ruins left behind by the illegal U.S. and U.K. invasion of Iraq in 2003. I think it's always important to remember that. And it's also interesting to remember something that Hosni Mubarak said. He is not someone I often cite, but interesting to remember what that close U.S. ally said back in 2003 to his American friends, to the Bush administration. He warned them that their war in Iraq would spawn 100 new bin Ladens. And at least about that, unfortunately, he proved to be exactly right. So the invasion transformed Iraq from a brutal but more secular dictatorship into a chaotic haven for fundamentalist terrorists. And the so-called Islamic State was then born out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which arose in that environment. Today, it controls territory across Syria and Iraq with an iron hand. It controls territory, in fact, populated by 8 million people. Thankfully, it has lost 25% of its territory since August, when the international campaign against it began, and I should say that international campaign began quite belatedly. People on the ground, Kurds in particular, had been standing up to the rising Islamic State on their own, and I think had there been more international concern earlier on, before Western hostages started tragically dying, but when many people on the ground were already dying, perhaps things would have turned out a bit differently. Today, there is an international coalition standing against the so-called Islamic State. I'll stop saying so-called. You got that for the record. That coalition is comprised of 60 countries and, according to The Economist, carries out a dozen airstrikes a day. However, the Islamic State remains very dangerous. I don't think we can overstate that. And not only the entity itself, but the idea. The franchise, which has come to be known as Islamic State, which has now caught on from West Africa to South Asia and beyond, is perhaps even more dangerous in the medium term. And certainly there are no words adequate, as a professor of human rights, I know this, to condemn the organization's beheading of foreign journalists and aid workers. But that is only the tip of the iceberg of its brutality. This demented band of brothers, as it were, that killed those hostages in such a cruel way does menace the security of Western countries, but make no mistake, the truly existential IS threat is to Muslim-majority societies and their inhabitants, both the religious majorities and the religious minorities in those societies. It is a threat to their way of life, to their very being in many instances, across a broad swath of the world. And in fact, Al-Qaeda affiliates as far away as northern Mali and Algeria, my father's home country of Algeria in North Africa, have pledged allegiance now to the IS black flag, something which is very terrifying to many people in the region. ISIS promotes hatred of religious minorities, of other religions, as well as those who practice Islam in different ways or choose not to practice. Its adherents carry out widespread torture and cruel punishments, mass executions, and systematic violence against women. It is first and foremost a threat to the human rights of the people on the ground. And all too often we forget those victims. We don't tell their stories. We don't show their faces on television. And so I really think it's in the interests of human rights that the Islamic State must be defeated and the idea of it must be entirely discredited. The UN has been issuing some very worrying reports in the last month, not only suggesting that Islamic State has been responsible for crimes against humanity and war crimes, but also possibly of genocide, acts of genocide, certainly, against Yazidis, Christians, Turkmen, Kurds, Shia, and others. We need, as an international community, to oppose that. And, of course, though not putting these things on equal footing, we also need to oppose abuses committed by those fighting the Islamic State. And in the reports from the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, there have indeed been allegations of atrocities by Iraqi forces fighting them. Not on the same level, but we have seen reports of killings, torture, and score settling with populations that are in territories that are reclaimed from ISIS. And all of that, of course, is a matter of concern. Now, I want to talk a bit about women and women's human rights defenders on the front lines of all of this in the region, I think, have been among the first to recognize the danger posed by Islamic State. I was very interested in the statement issued by the Women's Learning Partnership, a wonderful NGO founded by a prominent women's rights advocate, Manaz Afkami, who is originally from Iran, and her organization, which brings together women from many different countries in the region, issued a statement saying that ISIS is the enemy of women everywhere. ISIS is the enemy of religious freedom. It is the enemy of human rights. And they called on the international community to take what they suggested needed to be urgent action, saying there must be international acknowledgement of the tragic reality on the ground and immediate humanitarian assistance to displaced people. And they went on to address an issue that I think is absolutely critical, saying intelligence sources must release the names of the countries and individuals providing funds and military arms to ISIS, and severe sanctions must be immediately applied to all parties. This, it seems to me, is absolutely critical, even though it is a bit awkward, perhaps, for the United States government, because some of those in that category who were supplying funds, like the government of Qatar initially, and sources within Qatar, of course, are close U.S. allies. But we absolutely have to take on this issue. Now, as I mentioned, those who were on the front lines of fighting Islamic State long before the international community woke up to the threat were people of Muslim heritage and people from religious minorities living on the ground. And we really need to find a way to support them and to constantly remember that as tragic as the loss of American hostages to ISIS has been, in fact, the majority of the victims have been ordinary Syrians and Iraqis, people who died without cameras rolling, provoking only limited moral outrage internationally. And I think, for example, of Samira Saleh Al-Naimi, who was an Iraqi woman lawyer in the city of Mosul, who was picked up by ISIS last September, tortured for about 4 days after having condemned them on Facebook, in particular for the destruction of cultural sites in her hometown of Mosul, and then, according to reports, publicly executed. And I find it so tragic that we might recognize, as indeed we should, the face of James Foley or Stephen Sotloff if we saw their faces, because we've seen them so many times on television. But we probably wouldn't recognize the face of Samira and Naimi, who was killed by the same forces in a similarly brutal way in about the same time frame. And I think we absolutely have to change that. We have to pay attention to those victims of on the ground. I would also say, and speaking as a person very proud of their Muslim and Arab heritage, I believe that we have a responsibility in the Muslim community, people of Muslim heritage, Arab Americans, to speak out loudly and clearly against the crimes of Islamic State. And I think of a wonderful article written by a colleague of mine, another professor, Alham Mania, who is originally from Yemen. It's a really brilliant article called Time to Face the ISIS Inside of Us. And she, in that article, quotes the Kuwaiti Minister of Information from an article published last fall, reminding people that ISIS, while condemned by the majority of Muslims, is indeed, unfortunately, a product of a certain Islamic religious discourse that has been allowed to proliferate in the public sphere in the last decades. ISIS, he wrote, did not come from another planet. It is not a product of the infidel West, though certainly I would add the West contributed in unfortunate ways, nor is it a product of a bygone era. And Elham really challenges us to look at, you know, where this movement came from, why its discourse resonates with some small number of young people. And she concludes by saying it would be easier to look the other way. It would be easier. But if we continue to blame others, insist on our own inaction and silence, it is we and no one else who is letting our religion be hijacked by this fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. ISIS, she wrote, is within us. It is time to face the ISIS inside of us. But what I think is absolutely critical is to note that there are many people who have recognized this call. For example, there were a group of 80 Muslim leaders last August in India who signed a statement condemning ISIS. I could cite the head of Muslims for Progressive Values here in California, who has categorically denounced ISIS slaughter of innocent people as a disgrace to Islam and called on Muslims to go beyond condemnation and get to the theological root that is used to justify this theology of supremacy and of hate. Or I could talk about people on the ground, people like those in my book, like Yanar Mohammed from the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. Her organization not only condemns ISIS, but actually runs shelters for women inside Iraq, fleeing its violence, runs helplines. And yet when I had the honor of interviewing Yanar Mohammed, she told me that she doesn't really get a hearing in the West. And that absolutely has to change. We need to be listening to Syrian and Iraqi experts to understand what is happening. We need to find a way to support the human rights defenders on the ground. It seems to me absolutely critical that we begin first and foremost by sharing their stories, and I would ask you to help me doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bernard.
I would like to commend the Commonwealth Club and Celia for this program today. Approximately 1 year ago, we were talking about the Arab Spring with great hope, and the perspective I presented then presented the human tragedy of the uprisings, demands for more inclusion and democracy. And I still remember, picking up from where Karima left off, how affected I was by the lost generation of Syrian children, increased violence against women, as well as the loss of so many young men and men and boys. We all urge the world community to sit up, take notice, and become engaged. On the nation state side, we saw very little. Yet some individuals felt a calling for good and evil, and we've witnessed the barbaric, tragic results. Turkey has been in the foreground, forefront for some time, and there are allegations we've heard of they're not being active enough. And so today what I would like to do is to present this in the frame of the Turkish-American relationship and why we have some of the tension and perhaps the reports that have been out there. This is a very complex, as been referred to, a very complex issue, and I want to reiterate that the program for today speaks about the meteoric rise of the Islamic State and the ensuing disasters. Understand the term ISIS, Islamic State, ISIL, are often used to describe this movement. The two acronyms refer to the same group. ISIS stands for Islamic State in Iraq and Syria because the group's territory straddles the border between the two countries, as was mentioned. ISIL stands for Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. The Levant is the historic name given to the entire region east of the Mediterranean, from Egypt, east to Iran, and to Turkey. And therein we have Turkey. Now, the U.S. officials, you've heard press conferences and all, and someone will say ISIS and then they'll say ISIL. And the reason for that is that the U.S. officials use ISIL instead of ISIS to emphasize the group's goal to expand its influence beyond the borders of Syria and Iraq. And I believe, if I'm correct, Daesh is the Arabic acronym for that movement. It would make more sense, but as Karima said, we keep saying the so-called Islamic State or whatever, and the media's adaptation to call it the Islamic State group, because state assumes a system of administration and governance, not thugs and terrorists who are bent in rolling up territory. It has been said that if Turkey's geography were that of Switzerland, one could only imagine its foreign policy. But think, its neighbors, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Bulgaria, Greece, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia have all had at times with Turkey challenges that have tested the best of diplomats. So some years back, along comes an academic who becomes Turkey's foreign minister. Ahmet Davutoğlu, the now prime minister, believed that Turkey's foreign policy should be one of zero problems in the neighborhood. Well, that was rather short-lived, for we look at the region in which Turkey is centrally located. The region is fraught with human, political, and natural disasters. Turkey and the U.S. have had their ups and downs over the years. And like the weather, and I guess family relationships, it continues to change. Turkey made a commitment to NATO years ago. So this separates and puts Turkey in this strange straddling category. It became a member of NATO the same year that Greece became a member in 1952. Turkey's also said to the U.S. that if they had a strategic partnership with open discussions, then all subjects must be on the table, not Turkey taking orders or expected to perform in a certain way to please the West and the U.S. After all, if and when the U.S. and other allies leave the region, Turkey will still have its neighbors, as mentioned earlier. Perhaps this now gives credence to Prime Minister Davutoğlu's desire to achieve zero problems in the region. I am hopeful there may be a thaw in the bilateral relations between Turkey and the U.S., which hit a roadblock 2 years ago. And that roadblock actually was the Gezi Park uprisings. I happened to be there at the time, and a lot of what was portrayed was not the young people tearing up the city as we saw. That's what came across the media as parts of Istanbul totally destroyed. Well, that's not the case. What in fact was happening is that the then prime minister, now president, had this grandiose idea of taking the area around Taksim Square, a very historic area, green area, and running underneath roadways and then turning the park into some kind of shopping mall. And Turkey needs another shopping mall, like we all need another shopping mall. So what was portrayed in the West that made these young people who are asking for inclusion to be looked like the perpetrators of this chaos, in fact, was not so. So apparently the President Obama called Erdogan, and that was not taken kindly. Consequently, that's 2 years ago, we've had a roadblock in the relations, and because of Turkey's pivotal position there, we've had a lot of stumbling blocks and lack of cohesion, coordination. The lack of positive engagement and a period of 6 months of silence between Obama and Erdogan has had challenging consequences, impacting domestic and foreign issues particularly in the arena of Syria. Mr. Obama's initiative to phone Mr. Erdogan on March 27th of this year came at a time when the world expectation of the U.S. is to take a more proactive role against ISIL, ISIS. And herein lies the challenge that faces Turkey and also the U.S., and that is the divergent policies in Syria. I'm not here to say that one is right, one is wrong, but I think it is important to understand when there seems to be lack of progress, lack of momentum, lack of cohesion, lack of any type of action, that it's important to understand where each side comes from, and then to take the discussion. And this sense is Turkey. If we look from Turkey's position, where they sit and who their neighbors are, they're adamant that ousting Bashar al-Assad is its overarching goal. Well, up until now, Washington has prioritized degrading ISIS. And I find the word degrading a bizarre word. I mean, diminishing something that has had such a power, tumultuous and barbaric, disastrous relate, degrading is almost non-existent. Turkey's convinced that developments in the last 3 years have demonstrated, that is, developments in Syria, the civil war, the attacks by Assad on his own people, have demonstrated that Turkey has only a limited capacity to contain a threat from Syria. Turkey maintains that weapons given to the rebels, and also the U.S. in the beginning was very much for that. They were giving to the rebels. They thought the Free Syrian Army, the al-Nusra Front, an affiliate of al-Qaeda. Turkey maintains that the weapons given to the rebels were found to have ended up in the hands of radical groups who later joined ISIS. Mr. Erdogan, in an interview in January, maintained that the root of all the problems is Assad, who is a magnet to radical fighters, and that it would be impossible to eliminate ISIS unless the regime is defeated. Turkey could be a valuable partner for the U.S. only if it is convinced that it will help to lead the destruction of the Assad regime. The U.S. believes that preempting the growth of ISIS overseas is crucial to preventing potential terror attacks against the U.S. and allies. So this is where the U.S. comes into. To build on the March 27th phone call, when the U.S. indicated it would like to access Turkish air bases for armed drone flights and potential combat missions to recapture Mosul, Iraq from IS, Washington and Ankara will need to acknowledge each other's interest. While the U.S. and Turkey have been negotiating the deal to allow access to Turkish air bases, the training and equipping of Syrian rebels on Turkish soil, there'll be similar programs in Qatar, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, no-fly zones. There are other moving parts that both the U.S. and Turkey will need to stay on top of them. Some are help with Mosul, and today in the foreign policy issue I read that the exiled mayor of Mosul has said that the Turkish army will be helping rebels in the area of Mosul. Air defense, which is the no-fly zone, Turkey's domestic politics, role of the Kurds, and the wording of Obama's official statement on April 24th. Each of these listed above issues merits a study session, if not a semester on its own. In the meantime, if Ankara and Washington manage to navigate their differences as strategic and equal partners, then perhaps one will witness a bit of a warming in our bilateral relations that will be mutually beneficial and give a modicum of hope as well as positive results against ISIL or whatever names deemed appropriate. Above all, the refugees, the displaced, and those who have lost their lives trying to do good against evil needs to be honored, respected, and given a chance for a better future. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. That was Bonnie Joy Caslin. And now we will hear from Karaman Mamont.
Thank you for attending, and it's really my pleasure being here. And it's my time, so I can say good to see you, my professor, and it's my privilege really being here. Thank you very much. And one more correction, I'm not a lawyer right now currently, I'm studying. So I quite remember, I think in 2012, Obama went Middle East. And I remember there were complaining about, even by single war, he didn't mention Iraq in his trip to Middle East. However, in the meantime, in the Middle East, in 2011, all attention were goes to, I mean, to Egypt or the Arab Spring. And quote-unquote, I heard what we hear from an American veteran, and he say, nowadays everybody talking about Egypt, but believe me, one day we will talk about Iraq again, because Iraq is right now out of the control. We left, but jihadis, they didn't left. So, however, there's a relation between jihadism, violence, radicalism, and thank you very much again for, I mean, it's a privilege being with the scholar, and they try to cover most parts of what they did. However, if we look back, I mean, Islamism, it's like any other ideas. It's like socialism. It's like nationalism. So it's any other approach. I mean, in the end, they want to control the state, and then they control the whole society. So, I mean, if you look at the Brotherhood right now as an organization, they are doing the same thing. They are very active, socially, politically, even athletically. So they do every single thing to control and get the power and to control the whole society. So till this moment, there's nothing wrong. However, if you look, we're facing another chapter of the radicalism and jihadism in the last century, which is beginning of the Qutb. Qutb is a founding father of this idea. He's a reaction of the action. He has been tortured and executed. So he's very, very radical. He was purchasing Islam in a different way and forget everything about tolerance, living with each other. And he forget all the verses in the Quran, and he's just focusing. Everything has to be ruled by the God, which is sovereign. And anything behind it is not accepted, and we have fight for it. He's really inspired by the Maududi. Maududi, he was in another part of the Muslim country in Pakistan. He was fighting imperialism, and he saw that every single Muslim has to fight right now because we don't have any Muslim power, so we don't talking about Islamic tolerance. Whenever we get power, we gain power, we have our own state, and then in the next step, we could talk about the Islamic tolerance. So they were fighting. They have a new version of the jihadism. However, this idea, this foundation of the thought, it didn't work well until the end of the, or the beginning of the 16th and the end of the 17th in the last century, because there was too many events together, came together with those ideas, and then they changed the attraction and the following stage of these jihadist fundamental thought or approach. What's happening at that time? There's too many events came after each other. First of all, Arabic nation, all of them were defeated by Israel army. So that means they were looking for an alternative. So the Arabic secular country was nationalism, they were defeated. So they were looking for Islamic approach. The third thing is the booming and Saudi Arabia came to power. But in the end of the 17, by raising the oil price, Saudi get enough power and money to be able to control or dominate the Muslim society in the world. They were spending billions, and according to the Fariz Zakaria's book, it's over $100 billion just to building Islamic religion schools and whatever. They didn't build like a modern institution. And the third thing is about Iranian revolution. The Iranian revolution is a new concept. Even Osama bin Laden by itself, he was very, very attracted by this idea, by the Islamic revolution. This revolution, for the first time, the Islamic came to power and they changed everything in the state according to the Islamic concept. It was very appealing for all Muslim countries besides where Shiis or Sunnis. And the fourth thing, for the war in Afghanistan, for the first time, all Muslims together around the world, gathering, they came to the place and they were fighting and they were successful. That gave a very strong signal for all Muslims around the world. If they were together, fight together, they could do whatever they want, even they can't fight against the most powerful, like all the Union Soviet. So all together it came. That's why, I mean, if you look at the ISIS came, ISIS is as an extension of this, as an extension of the jihadist fighting in Afghanistan. Because Zarqawi, as a founding father of Jabhat al-Tawheed wal-Jihad, which was founded in 1999, he went to Afghanistan to fight, to jihad. But by the time he arrived, there's no more jihad. So he was still training to jihad. But when they were war in Iraq, he came back to Iraq, and all foreign fighters joined him. So he approached what he didn't complete in Afghanistan, he accomplished for first time in Iraq. So he came to Iraq, and then he was so successful. But in Iraq, he was facing too many challenges because he's a foreigner. He's not Iraqi. So he has a problem with identity. But he tried to make something to be beyond, go beyond this. So what he did, he said, we approach, we don't care about nationality. We don't care about border. We care about the Islamic concept. That's why we have to fight. And the other thing, he tried to take advantage of Shia and Sunnis. And the new constitution or the new political foundation or institution in Iraq, very, very helpful for what he was doing. He was very successful to how to start the civil war in Iraq and fighting. He was targeting, and they did a new approach. They were not classical. I mean, they were, in their way, they were fighting. They are totally different. They didn't do like a very controversial weapons, or they were fighting in a different, like a classical way they were fighting as a guerrilla approach. No, they were trying to targeting exactly specific target, like target the leaders, target the mosques, target the very symbolic target in Iraq, which in the end they were really successful to attract all Sunnis. And the Sunni, we should talk about one point. Tribalism is very, very powerful in Iraq. So the tribalism is one of the things that causing Iraq to be unstable, and it's not looks always look a modern, a failed state. Because the tribes, they are very powerful. Some tribes, they have over 3 million men, and they have extension in other countries. So those tribalism, they play always different roles. For example, if you look at ISIS in the beginning, in 2004 or 2006, they were fighting with them, with Al-Qaeda. But then when they tried to implement the radical version of Sharia, they were pulled back and they tried to fight against them. So they were very successful, and Americans are very successful. They defeat them. According to the report, by the end of between 2007 to 2010, 42 leaders of ISIS or Al-Qaeda in Iraq, over 80% of them were killed or captured. So there's a pullback at that time. If you look at in the beginning, in the first months in 2010, the Iraq is quiet. It's safe. And the rate of the crimes and terrorist attacks, it's below. We haven't seen in the last 10 years something like this. But then something else happened. ISIS is very, very, very successful how to change. They always change their name. They change this point. If you look at the name, they have changing their name in 2005, then in 2010, then in 2011. So they were lacking of the leader. And Abu Bakr Baghdadi came as a new leader in 2010. And 2011, it's a new year for ideas of the radicalism and jihadism again. Why? Because in 2011, again, something's happened. There's too many factors. The first thing, if you look at the Libya, the Gaddafi collapse, and all weapons came to under the control of jihadism. And in 2011, Syria had the war. So in this war, if you look in Syria, the war, it gave opportunity for, they have a territory to fight, and they get weapons from Libya, and then the U.S. withdraw. So there's a security gap, there's a territory to be captured, and weapons came from Libya, so they gained the power. And in 2011, they were growing because they have an approach, it's called breaking the wall. In breaking the wall, they were very successful to take out thousands of prisoners from Iraqi jail who's criminals or radicals. So right now they are fighting side by side with ISIS. So all approaches, if you look in this situation, that's why if you look at the ISIS, they were very, very successful, and they were very successful to implement this jihadist idea. However, if you look nowadays, this idea is not stay only in the Middle East. It's very, very attractive. It goes beyond the Middle East. I just want to let you know that 60% of the foreign fighters in the in Syria, they were following an imam in Michigan, which is Sheikh Ahmad. Sheikh Ahmad, he has over 250,000 likes on Facebook and over 30,000 followers on Twitter. I'm here if you have more questions, and we have more time to talk about this. But as I mentioned, we should remember the song that which is written in early 17. It's about Imagine, which is say, there is no heaven or no sky, and no hell above us. It's only thing is there's a sky. That means it's, we should have a new approach for religion. But religion is not cause everything. We have the atrocity following nationalism, modern state. However, in this point, religion is absolutely fail to save Middle East. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karaman Mamand. And now we'll hear from Dr. Meher Qaleji.
I'm going to bring a bit of realpolitik into this, move away from human rights, move away from religion, and bring back the memory that the last time I took part in a discussion here at the Commonwealth Club was back in July 2011, when we discussed the Arab Spring. The majority of the people who were here, including the panel members, were absolutely euphoric about the events that were taking place at the time. And we were all full of hope that change is coming to the Middle East. Well, history turned out to be different. There has been change, but instead of spring, unfortunately, we have ended up with a very, very harsh winter. The events which started at the time as purely simple secular demonstrations in whether it was Tunisia, Libya, Iraq, Syria, or Yemen, well, that changed. They evolved into sectarian, into ethnic, and into tribal feuds. I'm sorry, I'm going to bring some of the things which have been discussed already, but from a different perspective. You have to add to this the actions of certain governments who were hell-bent on seeking revenge for historical injustices, and they did this. And now what we have, or what we lit the fuse on, is a huge inferno in the Middle East, which will take not just decades, but generations to get rid of. So we have a really unpleasant mixture which has turned amongst us. When I was preparing for this, which is only like a week ago, I started looking through my old notes and papers, and I came across a copy of The Economist from February 2012. If you can't see it, the headline, the lead article is How to Set Syria Free in 2012, February 2012, that's 3 years ago. I'll read you just some of the extracts from the leader there. Quote, the people of Syria deserve better. With the number of dead rapidly climbing to above 7,000, the world has a responsibility to act. Unquote. 7,000. I mean, these were the good days. Okay? It continues later on by stating that, and that's very important, a lengthy civil war in Syria would fuel mayhem and religious strife in an unstable part of the world. Unquote. Quote again. So shifting Assad from power as soon as possible is essential. This is February 2012. Okay? Welcome to 2015. Many leaders, many countries have drawn red lines, okay, in the sand. Well, we know what happened to these red lines. They've acquired different shades of red. Red became an extremely interesting color in the electromagnetic spectrum, okay, particularly in the Middle East. Cue Iraq. Okay, I'm not going to talk about Iraq here, but it's very, very difficult and it's impossible to separate, okay, events leading to the emergence of what you want to call IS, ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, okay, in Syria to what happened in Iraq. And we've had some explanation earlier about that. I will only once say one thing about that, okay? And it's been mentioned, but I'm going to elaborate a bit more about it. IS or Daesh or whatever you want to call it is an indirect creation of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But it is a direct, okay, reaction or consequence of Maliki, the ex-prime minister of Iraq, his sectarian policies. That's where Daesh or ISIS came from. In December 2013, okay, Daesh was estimated, or IS is estimated to have between 3,000 and 5,000 jihadists. Okay. June 2014, with these 3,000 and 5,000, just imagine, I was monitoring this on the news websites, people estimating how many they have. This was in December 13, 3,000 to 5,000 jihadists. 2014, they took over Mosul in Iraq, with the help of the Sunnis, of course, who were disgruntled with Maliki, and spearheaded towards Baghdad. September 2014, that's 9 months after we talked about 3,000 to 5,000, they controlled approximately 35,000 square miles. Okay. They commanded the allegiance of approximately 30,000 fighters, and they ruled over 8 million people. It was a state. If you want, they control the state. They controlled oil fields. They controlled border crossings, dams, banks, and they had an approximately assets of about $2 billion. We've heard that they were receiving some support from individuals in Gulf states. But what was important is that of these 30,000 fighters, there were 12,000 fighters approximately who were foreigners from about 80 countries. 80 countries. There aren't 80 Arab countries, from 80 countries throughout the world. There's an EU analyst, security analyst, Gilles de Kerchhoff. He estimated that there were 3,000 Europeans who were helping IS at the time. Okay, enough of that. The consequences, we know people have been made refugees. There are 3.8 million Syrians who are refugees in neighboring countries, 7.6 who are internally dispersed throughout Syria. Now, one of the countries which had fighters in Syria was Jordan. That's the country I come from. There was some internal opposition to Jordan's participation in the coalition. And one of the leaders of the Salafist movement there was jailed in October 2014 for criticizing the government for that. I will come back to him in a minute. Jordan is in a particularly rough, unpleasant neighborhood. Yeah? We're caught between Scylla and Charybdis, if you want. Okay, we are, certainly. And, you know, we're trying to balance modernization, democratization there, for external economic aid, okay, and the refugees' needs, and trying to manage to stave off the storms that have been bombarding the region. Well, they've succeeded to a certain extent, but the murder, the capture and the murder of the Jordanian pilot, he was murdered in supposedly in February this year, that has polarized the public opinion in Jordan. And any support that IS had in Jordan is not tolerated anymore by the majority of the population over there. Now, I'm going to jump very quickly to my conclusions about this, the whole thing. So where do we go from next? Starting with Iraq, I think the Kurds in the Peshmerga, they have showed tremendous resilience. But, okay, they will use this opportunity to strengthen their stronghold in Iraq. After Mosul falls, and Mosul will fall this September, at a cost. There will be a huge humanitarian cost when it falls to the united forces of the Sunnis and the Kurds and the Iraqi army there. IS can only be defeated if the war in Syria finishes. No other way. Airstrikes on their own will not defeat IS. A long-lasting solution requires a Syrian-led, inclusive political process leading to a transition. And here is the thing which I find unpleasant, but I said realpolitik has to rule here. Okay? The situation in Syria has changed. There has to be a transition, or there will not be a transition, without Assad at the moment. He has a supporter. We have to realize that. He committed a lot, but he is going to be there. His departure cannot be a precondition. And I hear recently that even the Syrian opposition coalition agrees to this in private, not in public. Okay? Things have changed. Whatever the solution is, the country must maintain its unity, its sovereignty, and more importantly, its complete territorial integrity. The world can do a lot about this, but I've been asked to stop, and I will stop here. So I'll leave the rest to you now.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to our distinguished panel for their comments. Now it's time for the question and answer period. I'm Dr. Dina Brahim, today's moderator. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. What I will do is I've tried to categorize the questions, and I will try to ask them to try to begin with targeted questions, and then I'll leave some of them for whoever would like to comment. Karima, I'll begin with you because there's a group of questions that are really about the psyche of fundamentalism, and I really highly recommend that you pick up a copy of Dr. Banoon's book, which is in the back there, and because I believe that all the questions, these three questions, are answered in the excellent book, which I've read and I highly recommend. So I'm just going to jot down these three questions. What is your viewpoint on the motivation of suicide bombers? Is it religious belief, economic despair, hatred, brainwashing, or other? What is it about ISIS that attracts so many young people in the West to join them? And given the origin of ISIS in Western colonialism and hegemony in the region, if you agree that it's given, what can and should the U.S. and West do to neutralize ISIS and avert future issues? Would you comment on this?
Thank you very much for those questions. The motivation of suicide bombers, of course, it's impossible to answer that question definitively. It depends entirely on the context and the particular bomber, but I do not understand primarily, in many cases, if you're talking about jihadist suicide bombers, the motivation to be religious, but rather to be political. And that is the way I define the phenomenon of what I call Muslim fundamentalism in my book. I use a definition from an Algerian sociologist that these are political movements of the extreme right that manipulate religion in the context of globalization to achieve their political aims. So I think we should be analyzing this really politically. What is it about ISIS that is attractive to some young people in the West? And we should stress it is not only sort of people of Muslim heritage, but people of European heritage who are drawn to and then convert to Islam through the ISIS version. I interviewed Ani Zonneveld, who is the head of Muslims for Progressive Values down in Los Angeles a few months ago, and she said that she thought, I think this was very critical, she said that she thought one of the things that was making some young people vulnerable, and one has to stress only some young people vulnerable to this possibility of recruitment, was that part of the ISIS discourse sounds familiar, and this goes back to the point that Elhamania made in her article. Unfortunately, because of the infusion of money from the Gulf into Muslim institutions in Europe and North America, which has been allowed and indeed fostered by Western governments, Wahhabism, right, so a particularly extreme version of Islam that many criticize as promoting fundamentalism and indeed possibly terrorism in certain instances, Wahhabism has unfortunately become a part of the mainstream of the teaching of Islam in certain ways with regard to ideas about the superiority of Muslims over non-Muslims, about certain kinds of Muslims over others who are not good Muslims, and so on. And what Ani Zonneveld told me is part of what makes some, and she again stressed some young people vulnerable, is that part of that ISIS discourse sounds familiar. So we really have to take on not only the violence, but the ideology underlying that. And I heard that again and again in interviews for my book. So a wonderful woman that I interviewed, Sharifa Kadar, who is the head of Jaza Eruna, which is the Algerian Association of Victims of Islamist Terrorism, she said you can never defeat terrorism without taking on the fundamentalist ideology, because it is that ideology that makes the bed of this terrorism. As to the last point about colonialism, It's interesting. I mean, views really sort of differ about this in the region. I think in the West, maybe especially in a place like California, it's sort of chic to see these movements as kind of anti-colonial or anti-imperial. That's not at all how they're understood by many people in the region. So, for example, I interviewed the widow of Mohamed Brahmi, a slain left-wing secular nationalist Tunisian politician who was killed by jihadists in Tunisia in 2013. And she told me that her husband said that the Muslim Brotherhood was the big stick of colonialism that was sort of achieving, in the end, in a way, achieving some of the goals of colonialism in the region. And in fact, there are arguments that the British historically promoted the Muslim Brotherhood over secular nationalists that they saw as a greater threat to their interests. So I actually think there are multiple forms of imperialism, and Islamism actually has functioned as one form of imperialism in the region, where you have these foreign jihadis going into societies and trying to impose a very outside vision of Islam on those societies. And I think we have to really challenge that form of subordination as well.
Thank you. Honorary Consul General Kaslan, there are two questions related to Turkey, and I will urge all the panelists to try to keep their answers brief as we are running out of time. No, that wasn't a dig at you, Kerima. We might have to go about 5 minutes over, because these are really excellent questions, and I deeply appreciate your participation. The two questions are, one, why does Turkey avoid committing land troops to defeat ISIS? And the second is, as to U.S.-Turkey relations, isn't a major problem with the refusal of the Turkish government to acknowledge that it is one of the principal oppressors of free speech and free press in the world today?
Well, I'd like to take the second question first, free speech. We have seen recently a phenomena, and there is a law, I don't know how long it should remain on, it should not even be on the books, 301 point whatever, that has created a problem for, here's a country that took on democratic principles back and it's founded in 1923, and all of a sudden we find that there's more journalists in jail in Turkey than there are probably even in China. That does not speak well for the precepts of democracy, and unfortunately, I believe that right now we have in place a government that is very sensitive to criticism. That does not allow, in my opinion, for growth, for exploration of ideals and values. But what it has done is shut down Twitter, Facebook, and then they open again and given Turkey the impression that it is a closed society. That's created a great amount of tension for the population. And also then one needs to start to look at the politics of the present government, the AKP. The other question was, why is Turkey avoiding
committing troops to defeat ISIS?
It's not a refusal to commit troops. It's more of Davutoglu and Erdogan seeing a combined strategy from the West as well as Turkey. And so Turkey has looked before in the past incursions in Iraq at what the result has been for their own people. And it's a defensive mechanism that says, you know what? When you all leave, if you ever leave, these folks are still going to be here. It's not so the committing of troops, as far as a foreign policy, is not there yet. What has happened is that they have committed to looking at a joint training and equipping the Syrian elements against Assad, because Turkey still believes that the removal of Assad is first and foremost, but also it also means that ISIS must be defeated. So Turkey also has a wait and see, and part of that problem is that I think Mahir mentioned, it's that red line in the sand. The red line in the sand, it's crossed, and the next thing there's nothing, and Turkey looks at the U.S. and says, your refusal to take an action on the red line says you're giving courage to opposition, and indirectly, Turkey's also, meaning this government, is looking at its upcoming elections in addition to its foreign policy. So it's a very complex issue, not to just set foot on the ground right now, but it's also saying, you know, West, we've come with you before, and look what it's done to us.
There's a quick follow-up. Can you discuss why Turkey refused to support Kurds who were fighting against ISIS when it seems clearly in the interest of Turkey to see ISIS retreat from the Turkish border?
Is that for me?
Yes.
I think this is I think this directly impacts and affects Turkey's relationship with its own Kurdish citizens. That's what I think it is, because if we look at, and that's the Kurds of Syria, who are more aligned probably with the outlawed band PKK. We could spend a whole semester on discussing all of that, but I think it's also noteworthy to understand that Turkey also has, remember, Syria and Iraq are both Turkey's neighbors, but in Iraq, Turkey has a relationship with the regional government there. And it's interesting to note that for all, and this is where I say Turkey works this very convoluted, sometimes schizophrenic line on where it is and where its politics are, because I remember very clearly in the 80s, at the time when the Kurds of Iraq were facing such problems and persecutions, it in fact was the Turkish government in Washington, D.C., that brought Barzani and Talabani together in D.C. to meet with the U.S. government. So that being said, it says that Turkey's policy, I think, towards the Kurds right now in Syria, the Kurds in Iraq, and its own Kurds, are probably what I call very hazy, and I think it's in a daze. I don't think it is clearly defined even for them, and that's my take on that.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Islamic State. Our panelists are Bonnie Joy Kaslan, Honorary General, Consul General for the Republic of Turkey, Professor Kerima Banun, Dr. Meher Kaleji, and Karaman Mamand. Mr. Mamand, there are two questions here. There's an audience request to speak to the Yazidis' plight, and the questions are, is there a chance for the Kurdish government to release Yazidi and Assyrian political prisoners? And how can we support Kurdistan supporting its minorities to prevent starvation in refugee camps and help with resettlement?
Thank you very much. Actually, there's no promise. I mean, you can't do anything with the ISIS, because even you cannot get information. I mean, behaving like U.S. journalists is a message from ISIS. It's not just about it. It's a message like for journalism. I mean, we have a state. These days, there's only one story has to be told. There's no different stories. That's why beheading journalism. So there's no more stories. So you don't get information even how you get a chance to release victims. That's a very sad, I mean, situation. But we are hoping to defeat them. But how you defeat them, how are you helping Kurdish, actually? The U.S. has a different policy about the Kurdistan. I mean, but it's more realistic and diplomatic. So U.S. always worshipping the map has been there for 100 years. And in the last 10 years, there is no single bullet against America in the Kurdistan regional. But still, America, the United States opposing the independent Kurdistan. Because if you take away Kurdistan from Iraq, so who is a friend for a United States in Iraq? What's going to be left behind? Shiis, ISIS, Sunnis, and which part? What are you talking about, Iraq? But unfortunately, in last, like, the help for Kurdia, we need the help, because the Kurds right now, we have a very complex relation with the central government. They didn't get the portion of the Iraqi budget. And the help, everything, it has to be go still through the central government, then go to Iraq. I'm telling something, it's not my observation, it's a scholar and journalist observation. They were seeing In last almost a year, Kurdish has been fighting ISIS, and they already like 5,000 victims among even Peshmerga. Over 1,000 members were killed. But still, there is no single tank went to Kurdistan. If you go to the Baghdad side, you see a Shia militia. They were fighting with the latest army hardware. But if you go to the Kurdish side, you see they're still very, very, in a very beginning. They were fighting without not having too much supplement. In the last 10 years, the Iraqi taxpayers, you are giving $25 billion for Iraqi government to build 100 army units where they were defeated and run away. And you're giving only less than $100 million for Kurdish army to build 8 units they have been fighting in the last 10 years. Monsters against ISIS in the 900-kilometer border.
Thank you. Dr. Khalaji, I'll give you these two interesting questions. Would it bring stability to redivide Iran and Iraq along Sunni and Shia lines, much like the division in India and Pakistan? That's one. Two, it's been said that our administration missed an opportunity by demonizing Iran, perhaps the only Middle East country capable of some control of ISIS. Do you agree?
Oh, thank you.
Have fun with that one.
Okay. okay, Iran is guilty of a lot in the Middle East. We are seeing their interference at the moment in a number of countries, and I don't want to prolong the discussion in Lebanon, in their support in Syria to Assad, their support to the Houthis in Yemen, their support to the Shia rebellion in Bahrain. So whatever they say in public that they're not interfering, they are interfering and interfering in a big way. I don't think anybody in the Middle East outside Iran and the previous sectarian government of Maliki that trusted Iran. Nobody would trust them for what they do. And we hear what King Abdullah of Jordan has said. We hear what the Gulf monarchies and the Emirates have been saying. Even, I think, the Egyptian line on that is quite clear. So, no, I do not think they have a role to play in there. And any role that they play in there will bring more bloodshed to the region. Just one last comment I'd like to make, which is a very interesting snippet I saw yesterday, which is numbers. I love numbers. Does anyone here know which country in the world has the highest percentage of its population as IS fighters in Iraq and Syria? Anybody has an idea which is the country which has the highest percentage of its population as IS fighters in Iraq and Syria? No. Absolutely. I'll give you the answer. Save me the agony. It's a country which has 359,000 inhabitants. Uh-huh. It's a paradise, picture island paradise in the Indian Ocean, the Maldives. The Maldives have 200 citizens out of 359,000. That's one in 1,800. If you translate that into the 1.6 million Muslims in the world, which it means that we have about 880,000 IS fighters somewhere in the world. Fortunately, that is not the case. I think the number is much less than that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we have time for one last question. Earlier reports were that ISIS and Al-Qaeda had severed ties because of ISIS independent action. Can you give us an update on that relationship, both in Syria, Iraq, and now in Yemen? What relationship is ongoing between Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda in the new conflict in Yemen?
Is that to me?
That is whoever would like to take it. Seems you've got the tough one, so.
Okay, I have no problem with that. I think, as I explained earlier, even the leader of the Salafist in Jordan, who was released from prison to negotiate the release of the unfortunately now murdered Jordanian pilot, he took a very harsh line against IS, and he started criticizing their methods, calling them abhorrent, and they said they blackened the name of Islam. So there is a big shift between the Salafists now and what IS is claiming to be. We know for a fact now that there is mistrust and there's infighting between Al-Qaeda and their branch in Syria, which is Jabhat al-Nusra, and IS. They don't trust each other. They have problems with each other. And, of course, we see what happens when you have a political vacuum, like in Yemen, where we have Al-Qaeda now fighting the Shia Houthis over there. Well, that has nothing to do with the IS at the moment, but I think they are fighting in Houthis. So the issue is there is now an ideological split amongst these movements. And I think it's not hilarious. It's actually quite sad that when we understand that people like Al-Qaeda are being seen as moderates compared to IS. Yeah. It's funny how the tables have turned. And sadly, this is the world that we live in now.
Kenima, you had a comment?
I just wanted to add two things. One is I think that while competition between these groups is certainly better than their alliance, it is also dangerous because they will try to outdo each other in terrorist atrocities to gain the high ground and to gain recruits. I think that is maybe a small part of what explains the Charlie Hebdo attack in particular, which was Al-Qaeda trying to have a sort of quote-unquote spectacular attack and get back some of the headlines. And I also just wanted to comment, I am very worried about this idea now that actually is being put forward in some policy circles that somehow Al-Qaeda is considered to be moderate or vis-a-vis ISIS, and I think that's a very dangerous idea because they remain, Al-Qaeda groups remain a threat really across the region.
Thank you to our distinguished panel for their presentation. We also thank our audience here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Dr. Dina Ibrahim, your moderator for today's program, The Islamic State. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.